From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, President Obama tightens the screws with sanctions against Vladimir Putin's inner circle as Russia responds with a blacklist of its own.
You have to target the people who are the policymakers. Ultimately, this has to include Mr. Putin because his estimated value is $40 to $60 billion. All or most of it illegally got.
Also today, the D.C. families accusing the city of not living up to its obligations by putting them in inadequate and unsafe shelters. And we hear from an award-winning Nigerian novelist about her unique relationship with the U.S.
Very quickly realized in America that to be black wasn't just neutral, it wasn't value-free. To be black meant people immediately assumed you were not likely to be intelligent, and you were not likely to get the job or get the bank loan.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Hume. US President Barack Obama has announced he's ramping up American sanctions on Russia following its annexing of the Crimea region of Ukraine. Speaking from the White House, Mr. Obama said more officials close to President Vladimir Putin will now face asset freezes and travel bans, adding that he's signed an order that could see key sectors of the Russian economy targeted if the situation in Crimea escalates further. From Washington, here's Lorna Shaddick.
Barack Obama said the US is watching what's going on not only in Crimea, but also in southern and eastern Ukraine with concern. That's why he said he signed a new executive order that gives him the authority to go after key sectors of the Russian economy. If Moscow does decide to move further into Ukraine, the president implied, then its energy, mining and financial services sectors will all be among those in the crosshairs.
Russia must know that further escalation will only isolate it further from the international community.
That's the potential punishment, but the White House also announced it's now targeting more senior Russian officials and their associates, 21 in all, as well as a Russian bank, Bank Rossiya, used by many members of President Putin's inner circle. But Russia responded within minutes of Mr. Obama's speech by announcing its own retaliatory travel bans on 9 US lawmakers. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
Over in Europe, further EU sanctions against Russia are likely to be announced at an EU summit of leaders in Brussels. Another 8 to 12 names could be added to a list of Russians and Ukrainians likely to face travel bans and asset freezes. Meanwhile, the EU-Russia summit set for June will now be cancelled. British Prime Minister David Cameron says he expects EU members to be able to unite in their decisions.
The countries of the European Union need to speak with a clear and united voice. What that means is more asset freezes and travel bans, more action specifically in respect of what's happened in the Crimea.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is now in Moscow, seeking to encourage a diplomatic solution to the Ukraine crisis. Two Norwegian ships are continuing to search through the night for the missing Malaysia flight MH370 at a reduced speed using spotlights. Australian officials halted the official search overnight, saying it was too dark. Search teams are focusing their efforts on a remote part of the southern Indian Ocean after objects thought to be linked to the missing jet were found on satellite images. Four men in India have been convicted of the gang rape of a 22-year-old female journalist last August. A Mumbai court found the men guilty of rape, unnatural sex and destruction of evidence. Sentencing of the four men is due on Friday. You can catch our latest news updates if you follow us on Twitter at Feature Story. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A US Army general has escaped a jail sentence after the sexual assault case against him collapsed in court. The trial of General Jeffrey Sinclair highlighted alleged sexual misconduct, even in the most senior ranks of the US Army. Our US correspondent Simon Marks reports.
The trial has wrecked the career of one of the US Army's fastest rising generals. Jeffrey Sinclair received an official reprimand from the judge and a $20,000 fine. But he won't go to jail after the case, sparked by claims that he'd sexually assaulted his mistress, an Army captain, collapsed in court. The trial was closely watched by US lawmakers keen to crack down on sexual assault in the military, so much so that the judge ruled political considerations may have improperly influenced the case. Simon Marks, Washington.
Venezuelan intelligence agents have arrested Daniel Ceballos, the mayor of San Cristobal, the city where the current anti-government wave of protests began over a month ago. Ceballos has become the second opposition leader to be detained by Venezuela's government since social unrest began. From Washington, Andrea Arenas reports.
Mayor Ceballos' arrest comes a month after the party's leader detention, Leopoldo López, who is being held on charges of arson and conspiracy. So far, at least 31 people have died in clashes in which the opposition movements demand the government to address the country's high inflation and shortage of many staple goods in shops. Andrea Arenas, Washington.
An American teenager has been arrested after he broke in and climbed to the top of the New World Trade Center building. The 16-year-old was reportedly caught by security on his way down after spending several hours taking photographs of the iconic Manhattan skyline. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Hume reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
We're imposing sanctions on more senior officials of the Russian government. In addition, we are today sanctioning a number of other individuals with substantial resources and influence who provide material support to the Russian leadership. I signed a new executive order today that gives us the authority to impose sanctions not just on individuals, but on key sectors of the Russian economy.
President Barack Obama today turning up the heat on the Russian government sanctioning another 20 senior officials and a national bank following Russia's annexation of Crimea. Mr. Obama expressed concerns over Moscow's troop buildup along the border with eastern Ukraine, adding that punitive measures could be cranked up to include key sectors of the Russian economy. Russians on the US sanctions list, many considered part of Putin's inner circle, will have assets frozen in the US and be barred from doing business in the states. Moscow kicked back with sanctions of their own against US lawmakers, among them Harry Reid and John McCain. For more on the mounting US backlash, I spoke to Dr. Stephen Blank, Senior Fellow on Russia for the American Foreign Policy Council.
You have to target the people who are the policymakers. Ultimately, this has to include Mr. Putin, because his estimated value is $40 to $60 billion, all or most of it illegally gotten through control over energy sales. And there are people associated with him like Gennady Timchenko and so on. And when those people begin to be separated from their money, they will feel the impact. And but sanctioning people is not enough. Really, the entire Russian economy must be targeted here, because this is such an act of naked aggression on a scale we have not seen in Europe in 70 years. Or in the world since Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, that it really does call for a stronger response and not this kind of graduated response. Russia is not looking for off-ramps until it confronts superior force, and it has not believed until now that it confronts superior force.
But at least these sanctions are targeting what U.S. sources have described as Putin's cronies, you know, his inner circle.
Well, that's a step forward then. People like Timchenko and so on, who are his inner circle and cronies.
And, of course, a Russian bank has also been hit
right
by these sanctions.
Absolutely. The banking sector needs to be hit. I mean, ultimately, I have argued ultimately that we need to target Russia's banks and economy in a way similar to what the West has done with regard to Iran. If we can do that and reorient our energy purchases, we can force a political resolution, perhaps resembling Iran's having to come to the negotiating table.
Mr. Obama also expressed concerns over Russia's troop buildup along the border with eastern Ukraine. How worried is the US and the EU that Moscow's military maneuvers could be a prelude to another incursion?
I think that everybody's very worried, because it's very clear that what they're trying to do is incite a provocation that would allow them to enter eastern Ukraine. Beyond that, Moscow has made probes against Estonia, Latvia, and Moldova as well, and his overflights over Georgia in the last couple of days. So Moscow is placing its bets all along the line, because up till now, Moscow has been convinced that it's not facing strong enough resistance. Until it confronts real resistance, and unfortunately that has to mean not a real tangible demonstration of military force and a credible resolve to use them against aggression, then it will back down.
Do you think there's anything in the idea that perhaps Moscow could turn its attention to Transnistria, that breakaway region of Moldova? That could be next on the hit list?
Moldova is one of the targets. There have been a lot of statements to that effect. They have been warning about doing that, and the Moldovan government is warning about it as well. It's quite possible. The fact of the matter is that Mr. Putin's speech on Tuesday was a landmine against every single post-Soviet and East European state that came out at the end of the Cold War. It's essentially a declaration that none of the agreements made since 1989 are relevant. We won't observe them. And the justification for his revisionism is the same that Hitler gave in the 30s about ethnic Germans being lost in Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Poland, and so on. So strong actions. Mm-hmm. Strong action is needed here.
Mr. Obama, I mentioned he signed that executive order saying that if provoked, tougher economic sanctions could follow. But isn't there a danger that the global community could suffer here, not just Russia?
Well, there's a danger of that. But the point is, if collective defense and the vital interests of European security require collective defense and actions to uphold all those treaties, then the sacrifice is worth it, because otherwise we're living in a jungle.
Dr. Stephen Blank. Now, EU leaders are set to follow the US and broaden travel bans and asset freezes against Russian officials. They also announced plans to ditch a scheduled EU-Russia summit in June in response to the ongoing Ukrainian crisis. The country's interim prime minister was also meeting with the European Union to build trade and economic ties. Arseniy Yatsenyuk reiterated his anger over Moscow's actions.
I am disappointed what Russia is doing. That's what I am disappointed. And the world is to facilitate a strong response to everyone who violates the international law and makes an armed robbery, grabbing the land of an independent country.
As the US and Russia exchanged tit-for-tat sanctions, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was meeting with the man at the centre of the storm, Vladimir Putin. Our correspondent Anya Ardaeva followed events in Moscow.
With Muscovites hanging flags in support of Crimea's decision to join Russia, President Putin has been visited at the Kremlin by the head of the UN. But with Mr. Ban in town, Russia retaliated to increased sanctions with bans on US officials and lawmakers. And Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov signaled that Moscow is pressing ahead.
Practical steps are underway to implement the agreement signed by the Russian Federation, Crimea, and the city of Sevastopol about the entry of two new subjects of federation into Russia. The process will be completed this week.
Nonetheless, the head of Russia's diplomatic academy, Yevgeny Bajanov, says he hopes Mr. Ban's visits to Moscow and Kiev will help to ease tensions in the region.
At least it will be a little step in the right direction. I do hope. Well, I have to hope, and I'm sure all of us are interested in peace.
Vladimir Putin insists that he's acting in accordance with international law. But Kiev and the West say his moves are illegal and fear they're only the beginning. And despite President Putin's insistence to the contrary, Yevgeny Bajanov says Russian troops in East Ukraine can't be ruled out.
If Kiev will send troops to Donetsk, and it will be clashes, and people in Donetsk, again, who are Russians, or those who speak Russian, or those who like Russia, will ask for help, I don't know what is going to happen. I mean, we just cannot sit and watch if there is a war, because we're so close and so interdependent that if a war there means a war here.
The head of the UN knows that the stakes are getting higher.
As the Secretary General of the United Nations, I cannot hide but to tell you that I'm deeply concerned about the current situation involving Ukraine and also Russia. Russia is one of the most important leadership countries, not only in the United Nations and globally.
All the while, relations between Russia and the West become more frosty. And with such divided views on the crisis in Ukraine, thawing relations will be difficult. Ban Ki-moon's visit to Moscow is the latest in a long line of attempts to ease this crisis through diplomacy. But Russia does not look set to bow to international pressure. Anya Ardaeva, Moscow.
This is FSN Reports. Today marks the official start of spring, but weather forecasters predict a few more days of freezing temperatures in the coming weeks. Everyone likes to mock DC for closing down its public schools and government at every mere hint of winter weather, but less attention has been paid to how the city deals with its exploding population of homeless families. By law, the city must provide all eligible families with apartment-style housing or private rooms on every night with hypothermic conditions. In a case before DC's Superior Court today, a group of families accused the city of not living up to its obligations by placing them in inadequate and unsafe shelters. DC correspondent Alice Olstein was in the courtroom today and brings us this report.
This courtroom in DC's Superior Court, a group of homeless families accused the city of violating the Homeless Services Reform Act, which assures their right to a room in a shelter during severe weather conditions. This winter, facing a shortage of shelter space and a surge in homeless families seeking help, the city began putting them up in recreation centers. At first, the families had to sleep all together in an open room. Then the city set up 6-foot-high partitions on wheels, with no doors and no locks. Overhead lighting was kept on at all times. With the help of some pro bono lawyers, a group of families, led by lifelong DC resident Melvern Reed, sued the city, saying the spaces were in no way consistent with the legal definition of a private room.
It's privacy that I can lock my stuff up, you know, and not have to leave every morning and not knowing where I'm going to be at the next day. Okay.
Reed, who has been homeless for 3 years, serves as the sole caretaker for her 10-year-old grandson, and submitted testimony to the court that the conditions in the partitioned rec center were harmful to him.
You crammed a lot of people into an auditorium, no privacy. My grandson was scared. He didn't want me to even go to the ladies' room without him. But even still, he refused to go into the men's room and wash and get ready for school.
When a lower court sided with Reed and the other families, the city was forced to move them into hotels because all the shelters were full. Reed said she noticed an immediate change in her grandson.
He's taking his shower, he's getting in the bed, and he's going to sleep. I can actually, walk out the room and walk down the hall and come back, and he's fine with that. It's the fact that there's so many strangers around him that he's not trustful.
Just 2 days after being sued by the families, the city of D.C. wrote an emergency regulation changing the definition of private room. Attorney Jennifer Breckbill, who represented the families, explained.
The emergency rulemaking was the district's effort to define private room to comply with the partitions that they put in the rec centers. There's very little, if any, deference afforded to the district because it was in response to litigation.
At the court hearing Thursday, Judge Robert Okun blasted the city's move as a post hoc effort to defend the city against lawsuits and said he rejects their definition of private room. The judge also took a preliminary step Thursday towards making this case a class action lawsuit. Breckbill explained that that would mean any ruling would affect not only Reed and the other families, but all present and future homeless families in D.C. and all families housed in recreation centers this past winter.
Any relief that would apply to the named plaintiffs, who we've heard from already in this case, would apply to the other eligible homeless families in the district. So whatever the court finds, it will apply to everyone and we'll have the opportunity to help other homeless families outside of just our named plaintiffs.
Help in what way?
Help by providing them safe, lawful shelter.
City officials argued on the witness stand that they've ordered new, better partitions for the recreation centers, ones they say are interlocking and soundproof, as long as people speak in a hushed tone. With freezing conditions predicted for Sunday and Monday night, the city and the families will be back in court Friday to argue over whether these new partitions still fail to meet the city's obligation to provide private, dignified housing for the city's homeless. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
11 years after the US-led invasion of Iraq, the country is still witness to bloodshed and disorder. US forces who left at the end of 2011 left behind them a society rife with uncertainty, and perhaps no more so than for Iraq's female population. In a move that has outraged women in the country and rights groups, a new law is being prepared that could effectively legalise marital rape involving girls as young as 9 years old. To discuss the law, which has already been approved by Iraq's Council of Ministers, I spoke to Erin Evers, a researcher in the region for Human Rights Watch.
Because it was so outrageous, you know, civil society groups kind of dismissed it, and even the Council of Ministers shelved it, basically, and said that they weren't going to vote on it until after elections, which are taking place on April, or scheduled to take place on April 30th. And then come February 25th, all of a sudden, the Council of Ministers announces that they voted on this draft law and passed it, and are going to pass it along to Parliament. Parliament has to vote on it now in order for it to become law. Part of the problem with the law is that it's 254 very ambiguous articles. So there's still no official English translation of the law. and some of the articles, like the Article 16, which is the article that everybody's interpreting as essentially legalizing marriage for 9-year-old girls, doesn't specifically say 9-year-old girls can get married. It just kind of talks about, you know, the age of puberty and the age at which a girl is a woman, which implies that she can then be married. Men's right to divorce under the law, there's 6 different reasons that they can divorce their wives under the law, and 2 of them have to do with their wives having some kind of skin rash. But, you know, on the positive kind of note to this, I guess, is that it really has sparked outrage in Iraq. I mean, the only people who have really come out strong support of the law are the justice minister, who is the one that actually introduced it to the Council of Ministers, and the spiritual leader of his party. So that's good. I mean, that basically says that, you know, there's kind of a real cross-section of Iraqi society that thinks that this law is absolutely inappropriate.
Erin, has women's rights and, in the case of this particular draft bill, children's rights, because we're talking about girls perhaps as young as 9 being affected by this, has this as an issue been relegated in a country that's been in the grip of violence and disorder for over a decade now?
I think that's an excellent question. And I think, yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, because Iraq has been kind of in this chaos of you know, violence and war for the past 10 years, and then, of course, dictatorship before that, women's rights, the discussion of women's rights has really become a second-tier discussion. Like, well, why should we talk about women's rights when we have, you know, 1,000 people being killed in violent attacks every month? And there's some merit to that idea, but when you're talking about a situation that's ongoing, as prolonged as a situation in Iraq, and it shows no sign of ending, some point or another, you have to start paying attention to not only women's rights but children's rights, the rights of people who've been disabled in conflict, the rights of IDPs. So since the early 90s, but especially since the invasion of the coalition forces, women have definitely gotten the short shrift.
Erin Evers, a researcher in the region for Human Rights Watch. This is FSN Reports. Finally tonight, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is no stranger to winning awards. The Nigerian author's second novel about the Biafran War, Half of a Yellow Sun, won the UK Orange Prize for Fiction and in 2008 received a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. It's also just been turned into a feature film. But on Friday, Chimamanda added America's National Book Critics Circle Award to her list of prizes for a new novel, Americana, the story of a young Nigerian woman dealing with life in the US after she arrives to pursue a college education. FSN's Lorna Shaddick caught up with Chimamanda in Washington, D.C. and began by asking her why she felt the story behind Half of a Yellow Sun resonated so much in the US.
I don't know. I'm very happy that it does. I don't know why. But it's not just the US, though. I mean, when I went to Sri Lanka, for example, this is kind of a slightly random example, but I was so moved by the number of people who said that Half of Yeluson for them was very much about their own story, about what had happened in Sri Lanka. I think, though, that as a reader, I come to books looking for something, an emotional connection. And I read books from everywhere. And so I think it's possible as well that people who don't necessarily have a personal connection to Biafra or the story can find something in it. I think that's what good literature is.
Do you think that films about African experiences why do you think films, these kind of films about African experiences are resonating more here or becoming more mainstream?
You know, I mean, I don't think that there is a why. I think maybe the question that I'm interested in is, why has it taken this long? African stories are as human as stories from anywhere else. I think that it's been a question of access, because for films to happen, people make certain decisions. I think the decision makers have not always been perhaps open-minded enough, perhaps knowledgeable enough. They haven't had access to African stories, all of those things. I'm really looking forward to a time when we don't even have to talk about, oh, isn't it interesting that black people were honored this year, you know? But my hope is that it's not a fleeting thing, because that's the worry about these sorts of things. It has to become norm. And these people haven't been honored because they're black. They've been honored because they're talented.
Your new book, Americana, is obviously very much an exploration of what it's like being African in America.
I think, and in some ways it mirrors my own experience, because I think it's an experience that's particular to my being Nigerian, to my being West African. I think if I had been Kenyan or South African or Zimbabwean, it would have been different, because race is a reality in Southern and some parts of Eastern Africa in a way that it isn't in West Africa, particularly Anglophone West Africa. And so when I was growing up, I didn't think of myself as black. I didn't need to. It wasn't a thing. I just didn't. And intellectually, of course, I knew about race, because I was a child who read very widely. So I had read Roots, and I'd read, you know, books about slavery and that sort of thing. But it's an entirely different experience to come to America, which is a society that's steeped in race as an identity, and to discover that I had this new thing given to me. So a professor once said, oh, the black girl. And I remember thinking, oh, right, that's what I've become. And, you know, it's not even, the problem isn't about being black, because, you know, I'm quite happy to be black. It's that all of these negative assumptions that come with it. And so I very quickly realized in America that to be black wasn't just neutral. It wasn't value-free. To be black meant people immediately assumed you were not likely to be intelligent. You were not likely to get the job or get the bank loan. You were likely to be seen as poor. I mean, all of these assumptions. If you walked into a store to go shopping, you were likely to be followed because they thought you would steal. And coming from Nigeria, where none of these things were attached to color, I found it very unnerving. Initially, I used to say, I'm not black, don't call me black, I'm a Nigerian. Now I'm very happily black. But I think Americana is for me about the many ways of being black in America. Because I think when you're a person of African descent in this country, everybody lumps you into one. You know, it's all black. But there are different experiences of blackness. But I do think that there's certain advantages that come with being a black immigrant that often isn't extended to African Americans. There's a recent study, for example, about Ivy League colleges and how they admitted many young black students, but then you look at it carefully and you realize that many of the black students are actually immigrants from the Caribbean and from the continent of Africa and not African Americans. And, you know, the reason it's important, I think, is that the histories are different. I mean, I think that America has had a terrible history of racism, and that African Americans have really just suffered incredibly, but it's no longer cool to say that. You're not supposed to. So I think it's important to talk about. It's important to sort of acknowledge the many kinds of blacks.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, speaking to FSN's Lorna Shaddick. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the show by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. And you can also follow us on Twitter. We're there @FeatureStory. Coming up on Friday, we take a look at the very latest on the murder trial of Blade Runner Oscar Pistorius. That's Friday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Hume on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.